So we've just begun the second of the 7 points. The second point is the main practice. The main practice, of course, being the two bodhicittas, the wisdom and compassion practice. And in this text, it begins by talking about the ultimate awakening mind, ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom practice. And what's been said so far was that, as with every practice has two components, the actual meditation session, and then what we do for the rest of the day, which here is termed subsequent period practices. So we are now first looking at the actual meditation session. And it says here that the actual meditation session can be divided into these three parts: preparatory practices, the main practice, and concluding practice. So at the moment we're looking at the preparatory practices, how we prepare ourselves for the actual meditation. So of course these preparatory practices are the same preparatory practices we would do for every meditation, even though here we're talking about the preparatory practices for the wisdom practice. And so the preparatory practices, which were briefly described in that paragraph, we're looking at here in terms of the six preparations. So this is how these preparatory practices are laid out, particularly in the Lam Rim approach. So we're now looking at the third of those six preparatory practices, which is to take the seat through to developing the positive motivation of bodhicitta. So we've just been looking at the posture. So again, the most important thing with the posture is to have the body completely relaxed and the back nice and straight, so that we can sort of more or less forget about the body, that it doesn't create any interference in our meditation. So then, if we look in the commentary here, it says, having seated yourself comfortably on a meditation cushion, count your respiration, exhalation and inhalation 21 times. So this is usually done after we've prepared the body, found a nice posture. And the reason for this breathing exercise is to basically bring our mind into a neutral state. Because sometimes we come into the meditation with a little bit of a negative state of mind. And if we have a little bit of a negative state of mind and we try to develop bodhicitta based on that negative state of mind, it's going to be very difficult. But it's much easier to develop this positive state of mind from a neutral state. So what we can do is bring our mind into a neutral state. And also sometimes we come into the meditation and our mind is already churning over something. We're already maybe thinking about all the things we have to do that day. We've sort of skipped ahead of the meditation a little bit. So we have a lot of mental activity going on already. So what we're trying to do is to bring our mind into a neutral, quiet state. And an effective way to do that is to do a breathing exercise. Here in this commentary, it talks about counting 21 breaths. The exercise would be simply to take three slow, deep breaths, as we did this morning, focusing on the sensations throughout the body. Sometimes in the Tibetan tradition, you will see what's called a 9-round breathing exercise, where you imagine breathing in three times through the left nostril and out through the right, then three times in through the left right and out through the left, and then three times through both nostrils. All of these exercises have the same purpose, and that is to occupy our mind on the breath, so that we can let go of any negative state of mind and also let go of any mental chatter that's going on. So by doing this exercise, whether it's counting 21 breaths, taking three deep breaths, focusing on sensations, the 9-round breathing exercise where we imagine certain things as well, then all of those exercises, again, have the same purpose, to let go of any negative state of mind and any mental chatter, to bring the mind into a neutral, quiet state. And on that basis, it's much easier to develop the positive motivation. So that's what this exercise is here, 21 breaths. So it says here, with these practices, you enable your body, speech and mind to become a fit vessel for meditative concentration. So again, you enable your body, speech and mind to become fit vessel for concentration. You've got your relaxed body, your speech is your mental chit-chat has quietened down, and your mind has now come into a neutral state. It's not maybe caught up in some negativity. Then it says, then generate as a precursor the conventional awakening mind accompanied by the beneficial qualities of meditative stabilization. So then we develop the positive motivation of bodhicitta here. And so now we can sort of follow these prayers for meditation as a way of going through these preparations. So we've cleaned the place, we've made offerings, we've sat down in a good posture, we've done the breathing exercise to put ourselves in that quiet, neutral state. Then we can begin here. So here in the text it says to develop the mind of bodhicitta. But again, what we've seen is that as a good basis for that, we can do that short reflection on the four thoughts. So now, with that neutral state of mind, we can reflect on each of these four points briefly, and then really, as a result, come to the conclusion, I must correctly practice the true Dharma. So that would inspire us to put effort into the practice that we're about to do. Then, the next stage is, as said here, to generate the mind of bodhicitta, which we see here as the next verse here of going for refuge and generating bodhicitta. So we have the four-line verse, I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma and the Sangha. By my practice of giving and the other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So this is the two parts of going for refuge and generating bodhicitta. And so again, we typically would do that three times, as it's mentioned here, to really emphasize this mind of refuge to Buddha Dharma Sangha and to really cultivate this mind of bodhicitta. And to support that, we have the following four lines, the four immeasurables. So remember, the four immeasurables were the foundation for bodhicitta. So often then, as part of this developing the positive motivation, we go through these four immeasurables. So the first one is, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. So this, of course, is loving kindness. So this is loving-kindness is this aspiration that myself and all other beings to have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be free of suffering, and the causes of suffering, of course, is compassion. So there we're developing loving-kindness and compassion. Then may they never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. So this is the empathetic joy, is rejoicing in others' virtue and good fortune. And then the fourth one is, may they abide in equanimity, free of attachment and aversion to those near and far. So remember, again, we tend to have attachment to friends, those near to us, aversion to the so-called enemy. And so we need to develop this mind of equanimity, this sense of closeness to everyone. So these four immeasurable thoughts are also something very good to reflect on at the beginning of the meditation. So with these, with both the going for refuge and generating bodhicitta and the four immeasurables, the idea is not simply here to quickly read through these lines and tick them off. The idea is to reflect on these points. So as a beginner, if we want to use this as a basis, of course we can have this in front of us until we become familiar with them, and then simply we can look at the next line, you know, and just read it mentally, this precious life of leisure and opportunity is rare and easily lost, and then simply reflect on that for maybe 1 or 2 minutes, and then mentally read the next line and do the same. And the same with going for refuge and generating bodhicitta and the four immeasurables is to, we can mentally read them until we become familiar, and then we, of course, remember what to do, and then just simply reflect on that for a minute or two so that we can really develop that positive motivation. So that is up to step number 3. So now we're at the end of these four immeasurables. We've prepared our body, speech and mind. We've got a good motivation. Then the next of the 6 preparatory practices is what's called visualize the merit field. Because the next part of the preparation is, as we see in the prayers for meditation, is this 7-limb prayer. And this 7-limb prayer, the function of this is to support our practice through the 2 activities of purifying negativities and what's called accumulating merit. And these 2 things come up later in the commentary as very important factors in our practice, is that whatever practice we are doing, as a support for that practice, in general, in meditation and daily life, we try to purify our mind of negative imprints and negative habits. So we're trying to reduce negativity, and we're trying to increase the positive states of mind, which is called accumulating merit. Merit is a word for doing positive actions. So as a support for any practice, if we can reduce our negative states of mind and increase the positive side of what's called merit, this is going to support our practice well. So part of the preparation is to do that. And to do that, this purifying negativities and accumulating, what's called accumulating merit, it's often best to do that with respect to what's called the merit field. The merit field is who or what we do this practice with respect to. And the merit field, there's not a picture here, can be very elaborate. And, you know, often they have, like, the Buddha in the middle, and then, there's one there, actually, over here. I can't see the board. So this is a very elaborate merit field. So you can try to visualize all of that, but here we see in the middle, this is, I think, Lama Tsongkhapa, so he's the founder of the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism. And then we have all the different, we have on either side generally, remember we're doing the 2 aspects of wisdom and compassion, and so then those 2 aspects of practice are symbolized by the great masters who emphasized those lineages. Like on the wisdom side, we would tend to have Nagarjuna and Shantideva and so forth. On the compassion side, Asanga and so forth like this. So you would have then also, traditionally on the wisdom side, we would have Manjushri, the Buddha of Wisdom. On the compassion side, either Chenrezig or Maitreya. And then all the various lineage lamas. So these are all the lineage lamas. So if we were doing like the Lojong practice and we were being very elaborate, we may visualize here, you know, we can have Geshe Chikawa and Atisha and Selimpa, Shantideva, Nagarjuna, all of these lineage lamas who are part of the practice to visualize that. And then we have all the different meditational deities and so forth as well. So this is a very elaborate form. So particularly, of course, if we're doing some sort of tantric practice, then this becomes much more relevant. I think at our level of practice, this merit field, we can keep it very simple. We could even simply have, if we have a personal teacher, we could have them as the merit field. If we don't have a personal teacher, we could simply think of someone that inspires us a lot, maybe Dalai Lama, Lama Tsongkhapa, Shakyamuni Buddha. Visualize them in front of us. If we want to be a bit more elaborate, then we could have, as I said, to symbolize the two aspects of wisdom and compassion, we may have, say, Shakyamuni Buddha in the middle, and then wisdom, we may have Manjushri, compassion, Chenrezig, or maybe Maitreya, like this. So, and then we can make it more elaborate like this if we want. But I think the idea is with the merit field is to have something in front of us that is inspiring us. So of course we can have a picture on the altar of this merit field, a picture of Shakyamuni Buddha, our teacher, Dalai Lama, on our altar if we wish. But here, when it talks about visualized merit field, we're talking about mentally imagining these beings really being in front of us. Then we do this seven limb practice with respect to who we have visualized in front of us, whether it's just our personal teacher or Shakyamuni Buddha, Dalai Lama, Lama Tsongkhapa, Manjushri, Maitreya, Chenrezig, depending on who we relate to. So then the seven limb prayer here, we can go through this. And again, the purpose of the seven limb prayer is to help us to purify negativities and what's called accumulate merit, is to increase the positive aspects of our mind. So here, the first line is, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. So here, we are mentally bowing down to the merit field. And to do this in a good way, in the proper way, let's say, for instance, we have Shakyamuni Buddha in front of us. Then when it says, I prostrate with my body, speech and mind, what does that really mean? Is that we are bowing down to all the qualities of Shakyamuni Buddha. That we are sort of prostrating to these qualities because these are the qualities that we are trying to develop ourselves. And so we are sort of bowing down to these qualities. So it's not like we're worshipping a person. This is not what this means. So I prostrate with my body, speech and mind is to mentally bow down, acknowledging all of these qualities that this person has. So we're really mentally bowing down to these qualities because these are the qualities that we are trying to develop ourselves. So this is what the first line means. Then it says, I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. So again, this is generosity. So this second point is to help develop generosity. So we can imagine offering everything possible to, again, if we visualize Shakyamuni Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, or our teacher. And it says here, actual and imagined. So often when we talk about imagined offerings, in the text it says, imagine a sky full of flowers or a sky full of jewels or, you know, we can be very elaborate in making these offerings. When we look at offerings, and let's say we have our teacher in front of us, what is the best offering that we can give to our teacher? Practice. So what we can do, if we've got our teacher or Dalai Lama or someone in front of us, imagined, we can offer our practice to them. We can offer our attempts to meditate and what we're doing in our practice. Offer this to them. That's what would make that person most happy. Offering jewels and so forth, okay, but the best offering we can give to the merit field, our teacher, whoever we visualize, is our practice. So we can offer our attempts to practice to them. So that is the best offering. Question?
Yeah. Where do those pictures come from? You know, they have been somehow imagined and then put outward in an image, and then others see the image, and then they look at the image, and then they visualize them internally.
Yeah.
But where did this image start?
I think it's this, you know, this is sort of symbolic. You can see, like, you know, the two on either side. This is wisdom, compassion. So in each of those two groups, we would have all the great masters who really were emphasizing the wisdom side of the practice, all the great masters who were emphasizing the compassion. And then behind the main person in the middle, which here happens to be Lama Tsongkhapa, but it could be our teacher, we have all of those lines of beings above. That is like the lineage masters, that all the masters who, from Shakyamuni Buddha down to our teacher, who were doing, for example, the Lojong practice. And then below, we have all the various groupings. Particularly, this is related to the tantric practice in terms of meditational deities and so forth. So these way of grouping like that, I think, can be very helpful in having a clear picture of in a very extensive merit field. I don't think so. I think you can, in fact, in different traditions, the way that they're displayed will be a little bit different. Yeah. Like in the Kagyu tradition, you know, this is more of the Gelug approach. Often in the Kagyu tradition, you'll have the teacher in the middle, then you'll have all the Buddhas on this side, you'll have all the Dharma behind, you'll have all the Sangha over here, and then like this, you'll have all the sort of meditational deities below. So I think it's not a fixed way of displaying them. I think they're just certain ways to group various great masters so that it can be helpful. So remember, again, this is going to be something to inspire us. So if we can have a good, clear picture rather than just beings all over the place, I think that can be helpful for inspiration for us. So I think it's not any fixed order. There's no fixed way of visualizing them. That's my understanding. But this is often a way that is presented, particularly in the Gelug school, in this format. And I think in other schools it's slightly different. So then if we go on to the third line of the seven limb prayer, we have, I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time. So this is the aspect of purifying negativities. So I think here, for this line to be effective, you know, of course we can very briefly mentally think or say, I declare all my negative actions accumulate since beginningless time. And it sort of rolls off the tongue very easy and we can say, okay, I've purified everything. But I think for it to have some effect when we mentally note that is to very briefly think of any negativities we've done very recently, maybe in the last 24 hours, certainly in the last couple of days. And this can be mental, verbal, or physical. So, you know, maybe we haven't verbally or physically done any negative, heavy negative things, but maybe we've had some heavy negative thoughts. So bring to mind any quite strong negative thoughts, speech, or actions that we've done in the last maybe day or two. And then we can quickly go through a purification process. So remember, to really work on purifying our mind of negativities, we have these four opponent powers. I'll just briefly mention them here because later in the text we're going to look at them in detail. The first is to have sincere regret for having done that negative thing. Then, The second step is what's called reliance, is to reaffirm our positive direction in our life. In Buddhist context, this is often in the form of this refuge and bodhicitta prayer, because that's the direction we want to follow in our life. Then think of some practical remedy. So if the negativity thing, the negativity was you said something not very nice to someone, then you can just quickly mentally know, okay, tomorrow or when I, as possible, I'm going to apologize to them. And the fourth point is resolve, which is to make a strong determination not to do that negative thing again. So here in the seven limb prayer, in the preparation for the meditation, we don't really want to make this too elaborate, but to make some impetus on this third line, maybe we can think of just one negative thing we've done very recently and then very quickly go through these four points. And then that can be a very effective way of purifying this negative action. And this could take, you know, 15, 20 seconds, 30 seconds to do this for one negative action. Similarly, we have the fourth line. It says, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. So this is rejoicing in the merit, meaning all the virtuous activities of others, including ourselves. See, in our modern society, we tend to always focus on the negative with respect to ourselves and others. So we have a very unbalanced view of ourselves and others. So this fourth point, not only is it good for accumulating the merit, but it's very helpful to start to have a balanced view of ourselves and others, meaning to rejoice when we see ourselves or someone else do something very positive. So here again, when it says, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings, in a practical way, when we mentally reflect on this point, again, what we can do to make more effective is to think about some very good thing that we've done in the last day or two, and then rejoice in that. And then also, like the four opponent powers, is to make a strong determination to do that again. So we can do that with respect to ourselves, but also here, if we can remember someone else doing something wonderful in the last day or two, then also rejoice in them having done that as well. Because that also is going to be very helpful to overcome jealousy. Because usually when others do something good or have something good happen to them, we become very jealous. So here again in the fourth line, in a practical way, when we reflect on this line, is just think about something we or someone else has done in the last day or two and really rejoice in that. Then the next two lines go together, which says, please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. So this is relating to our merit field. So if we have imagined our teacher in front of us, then here, please remain until end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. The second line there, turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings, is requesting our teacher to guide us and others. So by mentally making this request, and also the first line is please remain until end of cyclic existence, is we are also requesting them to stay in our lives. Please stay in my life and please continue to guide me and others. And if we mentally make that request, then that will really plant very powerful seeds in our mind to continue to receive teachings from that person. There's a very nice saying from a modern philosopher, I think William James, who said, what we attend to becomes our reality. Meaning if we are mentally making this request regularly, please stay in my life and continue to guide me. If we really make that heartfelt request, I think we'll find that we will receive these guidance from our teacher. And if we don't have a teacher, making this request can really plant very powerful seeds in our mind to find ourselves coming into contact with a teacher and receiving guidance from them. So we should not underestimate the power of the mind. So this is what these two lines in the seven limb prayer are about. Is about to strengthen our connection with our teacher, and if we don't have a teacher, to make that request to be guided by others, by qualified teachers, and we can thereby find a teacher to guide us. So these are what these two lines are about. Then the last line is a dedication. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the great enlightenment. As we're going to see in the commentary coming up, there's one slogan says, there are two things are important in every activity, what we do at the beginning and what we do at the end. At the beginning, of course, is the motivation, to have the positive motivation, and what we do at the end is to dedicate. And by dedicating the positive potential from any sort of activity, meditation or virtuous activity, this will really direct it in a very good direction. So here, the dedication is we're dedicating all of our personal virtues and others to enlightenment. So that is going to really direct our positive actions towards that goal. So this is the seven limb prayer, which can be a very good way at the beginning of a meditation to again purify the mind of negativity and accumulate this merit. So is there any questions on any of these seven limb prayer?
In general, how long should it take? Like, it took me sometimes 15 minutes and it felt like a whole meditation in itself sometimes. Like half.
Yeah. The reason I'm going through this now is that this can be a good framework for meditation, particularly the preparation stage and the conclusion stage. And you'll be going through this actually with Richard this evening and particularly tomorrow in both sessions in a very systematic, slow way to really start to get a feeling of how to do this. And so then when we do our own meditation practice, of course this part of the preparation is that we need to do it properly. How long to do then, of course, depends on us as an individual. And as you said, it may be that to avoid sort of going in the way of just tick, okay, I'm ready, I'll meditate now, then sometimes we can spend a whole meditation session just on this. We could, in fact, devote an entire session to all of these points that we've covered so far and reflect on each point maybe for quite some minutes. Or we could use this as a preparation at the beginning of the meditation and maybe spend 5 or 10 minutes preparing ourselves in this way. So both we can do.
Let's say we're in retreat setting.
Then what I would recommend would be the first session in the morning to do this quite extensively, and then other sessions make it maybe a little bit more abbreviated, and then maybe again the last session of the day more extensive again, or particularly the dedication more extensive at the end of the day. So in that way, I think it could be useful, practical, is to really more extensive in the first session, maybe then a little bit more brief in the middle sessions, and then at the end, again, maybe particularly dedication more extensive.
Can I ask about the offering part?
Sure. You mean this offering or the offering in the seven limb prayer? This one.
Let's say we put like a cookie or something. What do I do with the cookie afterwards? Like, let's say that you're in the retreat session. No, seriously, like for a few days. You take the same cookie and you put it again, or something?
No.
What do you do? You take the cookie and you put it, you give it to someone?
Well, you could eat it yourself, but if you're in a retreat setting and you have some animals around that would like to eat the cookie, then give it to them. And if you're offering a lot of food and there are other meditators, you know, maybe it's a retreat place with other meditation huts, then you can give that to, you know, often in that situation people come with food to you anyway, then you can just parcel it up and a little note to the person who brings the food and say, please distribute this to the other meditators. Or to the people working in the centre who are supporting you, as an example.
And about the offering of the actual practice, is that a one-liner, or how could you please say something about it, how to do it?
You can offer, like, if you've been already doing some retreat, you can offer what you've already done, you know, but maybe you did something, you know, particular practice for the last week, you can offer that. You can offer what you're about to do, which of course if you offer what you're about to do, it sort of gives you a little bit obligation to actually do it. So if you offer them the practice you're about to do that day or in the coming week, that could give you a little bit more inspiration to actually do the practice because you've offered it already. So that could work.
Two questions. You see, one, you use the term merit field. I've never been through this in a formal way that you've explained. But
yeah.
While meditating, I visualize, see, Buddha, you know, with a lot of practitioners under a tree, like trying to teach. And maybe I'm listening or I'm prostrating and things like that. But is that a merit field the way you explained it? Because there's nobody on the right or the left.
No, that can be a simple merit field, Shakyamuni Buddha, yes.
Okay, the other question is that, again, not through this, but in generally I've tried to apologize and things like that or whatever I do, but I have felt practically it has made me very weak in the office. I'm not talking about it. I'm very serious about it.
Yes.
That in the office I realized that I'll next day go and say, I'm sorry, I shouted at you. And people will look at what is wrong with him and suddenly he's blowing hot and cold. So my reputation has become a boss who's very hot and cold. You don't know when he goes crazy and when he's suddenly apologizing. Because one day I meditated, the other day I haven't. It's very serious.
Sure.
And then there would be people in my side, then what is wrong with you? Be in your element. Today is the review. Come on, don't do it. So there will be people who will be provoking me to get my aggressive self out, and then it is when that the job gets done. And when I'm not the hard task master, it is not. So there's a conflict within me as to who I am and what am I supposed to be.
Yeah.
Because when I'm apologizing and when I'm suddenly, one fine day I've had a good meditation day at home, I'm a little too quiet and I'm, you know, being very nice to everybody. And the other day I'm blowing my top off.
Sure. Yeah. You know, often people feel that apologizing or being compassionate is a sign of weakness. Actually, it's opposite. Anger is a sign of weakness, not being able to deal effectively with the situation. We have to resort to anger to get our way. So anger actually is a sign of weakness. Patience, compassion, apologizing when we've done something wrong is a sign of strength. So, of course, we now as a beginner have mental afflictions, and so sometimes we get angry, say the wrong thing. So I think that, you know, by apologizing, then when we've actually done something wrong, people will respect us more for that. But remember, with being cherishing other, this is going to come up later, but I'll address it now because it's important, is when we talk about apologizing or being compassionate or cherishing others, we have to do that with wisdom. Otherwise, we will end up as a doormat and people will trample over the top of us. But that's not because we've apologized or we're being kind to them. That's because we're missing the wisdom. So if we've really done something wrong, then we should say, sorry, you know, I blew my stack yesterday. I said some very harmful things which are not true. I apologize for that. And people, I think, will respect us for that. Then, of course, if they interpret that as somehow we're being a bit weak and they try to take advantage of that and walk over us, then we need to be very firm. But not with anger, not attacking the person, but really not accepting that behavior. And if we do that consistently, then I think people will have much more respect for us. They will know that when they've done something wrong and that we are addressing their negative behavior, that we're not attacking the person. And that we've done something wrong, we can have the the courage and to apologize to that. So I think people would respect us more for that. The problem is that when people start to go this way and try to be compassionate and kind and cherishing others, they forget about the wisdom. And then they end up being a doormat and people trample all over them. And they think, oh, this apologizing, being kind and compassionate just doesn't work. I better go back to being angry. But anger doesn't fix anything. And what we need to do is make sure that we have the wisdom with that attitude. Then it will work. We'll have a more harmonious team. People will not walk over the top of us. They will respect us much more, I think. That's my experience anyway. Okay. Anything else on seven limb prayer? Otherwise we will move on. So the fourth point was to visualize the merit field, and the fifth point was of course to do this seven limb prayer. And then the sixth point is to is what's called request blessings, which is what we see in the next four-line verse here, this request. So at the end of the seven limb prayer, we've got that merit field visualized in front of us. Again, maybe it's simply our teacher or Shakyamuni Buddha. We've gone through that seven limb prayer. Then the next point, and this is the last point before we actually begin the proper meditation, is what's called request blessings. And usually when people see this, they get some strange idea of what is a blessing. You know, and often we hear about, oh, the Dalai Lama's giving a blessing, you know. And so everyone rushes down there to the temple thinking that they'll sit there and somehow the Dalai Lama is going to zap them and they'll see the light or something will happen. Something magical will happen. And so often that, of course, doesn't happen, and then people say, well, this blessing thing doesn't work. Actually, a couple of years ago, I was actually down the temple with a small group. We had a sort of an audience with the Dalai Lama, and he gave a little talk to us. And at one point he said, I can't give you a blessing. Whether or not you get a blessing is up to you. And the word blessing in Tibetan is chinlap, which literally means to transform into a magnificent state. So a blessing is to transform our mind into a very positive state. And so when the Dalai Lama said he can't give us that, it's up to us whether we receive that. What he's saying is that to receive a blessing, we have to be open and we have to receive inspiration from that person. That's the blessing. So here, in this request, what we are doing is, at the beginning of the meditation, before we begin to meditate, is we are requesting the merit field. Again, let's assume it's our teacher. We're requesting our teacher to inspire and guide us in this meditation. And then usually what we do is we imagine that a teacher, whoever the merit field is with, turns into light and descends into our body and merges with us. And usually imagining the light comes down to our heart area. And as a result of that, we should be blessed in terms of we should be now very uplifted and inspired that our teacher is now really here to help us. So that's what request blessings means, is to do this visualization of imagining that our teacher dissolves into us. We become one with our teacher, and thereby now we are very inspired and uplifted to do this meditation. So this is the last point before we start the meditation. So having gone through all these points, we should now find that our mind is in a very positive, uplifted, joyful state. That's the best state to start the meditation. So that's what the purpose of all of these points are here. And so this evening you're going to go through that with Richard in the evening meditation in a very slow, methodical way. Here in the request, we see that it's a very general request. It says, please bless me to cease all deluded minds immediately from disrespect for the gurus up to the subtle dualistic conception, which is covering basically all the topics in the Lam Rim. Bless me to generate all unmistaken minds instantly from respect to the gurus to the realization of emptiness. Bless me to completely pacify all outer and inner obstacles. So I think, again, what we can do sometimes to make that more effective is to make it more personal in terms of, let's say we're about to do some sort of Lojong practice here, maybe one of these ultimate or conventional bodhicitta. Then in the request here is we can simply request our teacher to inspire us in our meditation that we're about to do. Please inspire and guide me to be able to meditate on bodhicitta, on emptiness and so forth, and then visualize them absorbing into us. So we can make that request very specific about what we're about to just do. So this is all the things we do as the preparatory practice. And then we see at the end the dedication prayer. We see back in the commentary it says the meditation session divides into three: preparatory practices, the main practice, and concluding practice. So the concluding practice is these dedication prayers. So I won't go into those now because they come later. So this, right down to the request, is all this preparatory practices. So any questions on those before we move on in the text? Yeah.
We are talking about preparations, but what do you think about yoga as a preparation for meditation?
So, of course, with meditation, it's very helpful to do body work. You know, so doing yoga, asanas, tai chi, qi gong, any body work like that, I think can be very helpful. And depending on the style of body work we do, it could be helpful to do some of that before any of this, depending on what the result of that body work is. If the result of that body work is that we become very sort of drowsy and sleepy, maybe not. But if we become very energetic, uplifted, then maybe we can do some of this before the meditation session. Yes, sure. And in general, I think it's very important to have a healthy body, of course, absolutely. Okay, let's move on in the commentary then. So again, you'll be going through these practices in some detail with Richard this evening and again tomorrow as well to become familiar with them. So now we are down at the bottom of page 90. So at the end there it says, with these practices, then generate as a precursor the conventional awakening mind accompanied by the beneficial qualities of meditative stabilization. So, beneficial qualities of meditative stabilization. Meditative stabilization, of course, is talking about the concentration practice, the shamatha practice. So what this is saying is that also it's very important as part of this preparation to have a very calm, clear, focused mind. Because in order for any meditation to be effective, we need a very calm, clear, focused mind. And then if we go on to the next paragraph, it says, during the main session, given that all of these mind training practices adhere to the tradition of simultaneous engagement, you should simultaneously meditate on the emptiness of all phenomena, including that of your own self and the self of others. Although this is true, during the preparatory stage, you must relate to these phenomena in a gradual manner, enumerating each phenomenon by means of the pristine cognition of discriminative awareness. This, the master said, has the benefit of allowing the moisture of tranquil abiding to give birth to the shoots of realization. So what does all that mean? Well, firstly, it talks about this tradition of simultaneous engagement. And this comes a little bit... So this, remember, this text was put down by Geshe Chikawa. And Geshe Chikawa actually was quite a lot involved in the Nyingma tradition. And in the Nyingma and Kagyu tradition, they emphasize the practice of nature of the mind, and they emphasize this trying to rest in this very subtle, clear light mind. And in that approach, then they talk much more about this simultaneous engagement in terms of coming to realize the emptiness of all phenomena simultaneously. So this is what is being mentioned here about the simultaneous engagement. But then it says, although this is true, during the preparatory stage, so the preparatory stage, of course, is us as a beginner, is it says that it's useful or helpful to do this in a gradual manner. Meaning, it says, enumerate each phenomena. Meaning, because here, we're talking about our wisdom practice, the wisdom of emptiness. So what it's saying here is that as a beginner, we need to enumerate each phenomena. Means we need to pick a particular phenomena that we need to investigate with our discriminative awareness. Is that we need to focus on a particular phenomena and investigate how that phenomena exists. Using our discriminative awareness to come to realize that that phenomena is empty of independent existence, to come to realize emptiness. So that's what's being mentioned here. And it says, this the master said. So many times in this commentary you will see the term the master said. So remember, this commentary is by Ser Chulbu Chegi Gyaltsen, one of the main disciples of Geshe Chikawa. And this commentary is basically his notes from the teachings he received from Geshe Chikawa. So when he says the master, he's talking about his own master, his own teacher. So the master here is always referring to Geshe Chikawa, his own teacher. It says, this has the benefit of allowing the moisture of tranquil abiding to give birth to the shoots of realization. So tranquil abiding here is a translation of shamatha. So what it says is that by doing this in this way, our shamatha, the moisture of shamatha, will give birth to the shoots of realization. So what this is saying is that in our practice, in any practice, but particularly here we're talking emptiness practice, is we go through some stages in our practice. And I like to use the Tibetan words because they're very short and they're very succinct. And the three Tibetan words is gol, nyam, tok. And these are three stages we go through in our practice in general, but here we're talking about emptiness practice. So the first stage is gol, which is meaning intellectual understanding. So of course, if we're going to meditate on emptiness, we're going to meditate on the nature of reality, we have to have some framework for practice. We have to have some intellectual understanding of what emptiness is and how we go about the practice. So this is intellectual understanding we're developing first of emptiness. Then of course, we apply this understanding in meditation. And we do, as suggested here in the text, is that we use the pristine cognition of discriminative awareness. So discriminative awareness means here we're discriminating, we're investigating a particular phenomena to see how it exists. And then through that investigation in meditation, we can come to realize that things are, that thing is empty of independent existence. Then we can have a little experience or taste of emptiness. So that's nyan. We can have some little taste or experience of emptiness. But of course, since our mind is not very stable, then that little experience of emptiness probably won't affect our mind very much. But it may still affect our mind a little bit after the meditation. So if we do this investigation and we come to this little experience of emptiness, particularly if our concentration is not too bad, that may have a bit of a deeper impact on our mind, which means that after the meditation, there may be some residual effect of that meditation. That may last for some minutes, hours, days, maybe even a few weeks. But then eventually that experience will wear off as our old habits reassert themselves. And then we'll go back to normal. So what we need to do, of course, is we need to make those experiences more stable and more lasting. And that is thok, which is realization. So if we want our experience of emptiness to have some lasting impact on us, that is called realization. For that to occur, the text says, the master said, this has the benefit of allowing the moisture of tranquil abiding, or the moisture of shamatha, to give birth to the shoots of realization. Which means, if we want to realize emptiness, if we want to have that as a stable experience, we need shamatha. We need a very stable, clear mind. So in order to for that experience to be a more lasting, stable experience, for it to become a realization, we need shamatha. And with this realization, when we talk about emptiness, this realization can come in two forms or two levels. We can have a conceptual realization of emptiness, and we can have a non-conceptual realization. Sometimes this is called direct. Because this realization of emptiness, the realization of emptiness, is a realization that nothing exists independently. Because now there appears to be a subject-object duality. There appears to be a me here and a world there, independent. So we live in this apparent dualistic world. And so in this dualistic world, of course, we have conceptions and language. And so when we first come to experience and realize emptiness, that experience is still conceptual. Meaning, when we first have an experience or realization, in that experience, there's still a sense of me, the meditator, realizing this thing emptiness. There still appears to be a meditator and an emptiness that we're realizing. There appears to be this subject-object duality. So it still is a conceptual experience. But as we deepen that realization, then it will turn into a direct, non-conceptual realization of emptiness. In that experience or realization of emptiness, in that experience, at that time, in the middle of the experience, there's no longer a sense of me, the meditator, and emptiness, the object. There's just the experience of emptiness. So this is what we're talking about in terms of realizing emptiness, is we're going through these stages. So if we want our little taste or experience of emptiness to move into becoming a realization, we need, as the text says here, we need shamatha. We need a very stable and clear mind. Because if our mind is not stable and clear, that taste of emptiness won't penetrate deeply enough for it to be a realization. We'll simply have some little taste that will wear off very quickly, and that's where we'll be stuck. Of course, that's a useful experience, and it can inspire us to continue to practice, and it may have a little bit of positive impact for a short time in daily life, but then it'll wear off. So we need to move to this level, and to do that again, we need the mind of shamatha. So what I'd like to do now, before we jump into the emptiness practice, is look at the shamatha practice. Because as we saw yesterday, in all levels of practice, we have the three core areas of practice: ethics, concentration, wisdom. Concentration practice, of course, is this shamatha practice. And not just emptiness. If we want to realize anything, if we want to realize bodhicitta, impermanence, dukkha, no self, for any meditation to come as a realization, we need shamatha. Otherwise, we'll just have a little taste of compassion, a little taste of dukkha, it'll all wear off, it'll wear off, it'll wear off. So, for any practice to be effective, we need a stable, clear mind. And so that's why I'd like to now spend a little bit of time looking at the shamatha practice so we know how to do that. Particularly as a beginner is very important. Particularly, I think, in our modern society, we're bombarded by so much stimulus that our minds are completely out of control. And unfortunately, modern technology, which sometimes has good uses, is making that situation worse. You know, the whole smartphone SMSing and all that is a nightmare in terms of attention skills. I mean, it's going downhill fast. So attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is on the increase. A lot to do with bad diet and technology, unfortunately. So let's have a look at what we can do to reverse that trend. And so I want to look at the shamatha practice. And for this, we're going to be using this handout here that you have. Shamatha. So, again, the three core practices: ethics, concentration, wisdom. So, concentration in Sanskrit is samadhi. And in the spiritual path, we can develop many levels of concentration. Often in the text it talks about 9 levels of concentration, 9 levels of samadhi. The minimum level of concentration we need to develop is shamatha. Which often is translated into English as calm abiding. Here it's translated as tranquil abiding. Above shamatha we have higher levels of concentration we can develop. The 4 levels above that are called the 4 jhanas, which actually in the Theravada traditions, when they talk about concentration practice, normally you don't hear much about shamatha. You'll hear a lot about developing the four jhanas in the Theravada traditions. Above that, we have which often are called the four samapatti in Sanskrit, which often in English is translated as something like absorption. Where the mind becomes progressively more absorbed. In terms of the spiritual path, in terms of our practice as a basis for the wisdom and compassion practice, shamatha and the four jhanas, very good. The four samapattis don't really help because our mind is too absorbed. We're not able to investigate and discriminate anymore. They're a very absorbed state, very peaceful state, good state to hang out in, but not much good for as a basis for these practices of emptiness and bodhicitta. But all of these here are very stable and very good base. The minimum we need is shamatha. So that's what we're going to be talking about now here. So, as with what we've mentioned already, how to train in the shamatha practice is that, as with the practices we just mentioned, in the beginning of the meditation, we need to prepare body, speech, mind. We need to go through the same preparation as we mentioned before, in terms of a good posture, doing the breath exercise, setting good motivation, and so forth. Bodhicitta, refuge, and so forth. And then, of course, in the actual practice, we are trying to develop two qualities. The first quality we're trying to develop is stability, to stabilize the mind. And the fault that we're trying to overcome here is distraction. That we try to focus on an object and our mind constantly becomes distracted. So stability is to stabilize the mind, to be able to focus on an object without becoming distracted. Normally in the meditation text, the fault is not listed as distraction, but it's listed as excitement. Because the most common form of distraction, of course, is, you know, we're trying to focus on the breath and we get distracted by some pleasant thing, the so-called sense pleasures. So often the fault is called excitement rather than distraction, because that's the most common type of distraction. But not only do we need to develop a stable mind, a mind that does not become distracted from the object, but we need to be able to focus on the object very clearly. So the second quality we're trying to develop is clarity, to be able to focus clearly on the object. And of course the fault that we're overcoming here is dullness, that the object is not appearing very clearly, our mind is very dull. The technical word for that in the text is often laxity. But I think in our modern society, we need to add another quality to the list. And it comes first. that is relaxation. And the fault here, of course, is tension, tightness. Normally in the meditation text, this wasn't listed. Only these two qualities were listed as the qualities we need to develop in the shamatha practice. But I think it's important to add that at the beginning, because unfortunately in our modern society, we are bombarded by stimulus, we have very hectic, busy lifestyles, we have a lot of tension and stress in our life. And because our minds are so chaotic, then generally when we want to focus on something, we clamp down forcibly. We have a lot of tension in our focus. Because if we don't have that, our mind just becomes completely distracted. And if we want to focus for a short time, that might work sort of okay. But we know from our own experience, if we focus on something in a very tense way for a longer time, we usually become very tired, fatigued, and often a lot of agitation builds up in our mind. So this is not the approach to follow in shamatha practice. And the very first quality we need to develop is relaxation. Because if we don't have a relaxed body and a relaxed mind, not only in shamatha meditation, but any meditation, we're going to have all sorts of problems in their meditation. In fact, probably as a beginner, most of the problems that you will experience in meditation will be simply because you're trying too hard. You're too tight, you're too tense. So the first thing we need to do is to learn how to relax. And again, historically, in ancient India, ancient Tibet, that wasn't really a big problem. In fact, the problem was people were too relaxed. And so actually in the meditation texts on shamatha, some of the very first instructions you'll see at the beginning, it'll say something like, tightly focus on the object, or firmly focus on the object. Because people were so relaxed, they were so dull, they needed to apply some effort. But of course, if we see that now, we're already super tight and tense, and then we clamp down even more, it's just a huge mess. So the first thing we really need to do is we need to learn to relax, 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 relax. Have a relaxed body, relaxed mind. Because again, generally in our daily life, we oscillate between two states. That if we want to be alert, we have to be very tense. If we want to be relaxed, we're half asleep. That's how we relax. We become very sleepy. And if we want to be alert, we're very tense. So we need to be alert and relaxed. That's what we're trying to develop here. To be alert and relaxed. Not alert and tense or relaxed and dull. So we need to find that middle way. And that begins by developing relaxation. And then on that basis, we stabilize the mind and then we work on improving the clarity. So we need to work on these three qualities in this order. That's why I mentioned before is, and particularly important with shamatha practice, is to keep the sessions very short. Because as a beginner, if you try to meditate too long, you're going to simply end up going into distraction or dullness, or both, oscillating. So as a beginner, we need to keep the sessions very short, particularly in the shamatha practice. And if we want to meditate longer, then we break up the session into two or three smaller sessions with a short break in the middle. So this is very important. Otherwise in shamatha practice, if we simply try to focus on the breath for an hour, we're simply going to end up becoming very dull or completely distracted. And that's not going to help at all. Because we're trying to overcome distraction and dullness. We've sort of run out of time, but so is there any last questions on this before we leave it there for today. So what I'm going to do tomorrow is go on to talk about the various objects we can use in shamatha practice, what tools we use, what faults we need to overcome, and then we're going to look at how to progress in our shamatha practice using this diagram here as well. So I plan to spend probably most of tomorrow morning talking about the shamatha practice, because I think it's very important. Of course, all Buddhist traditions say in the text that shamatha practice or concentration practice is one of the three core practices. But then it seems like when it comes to actual practice, it sort of gets left out. You know, in a lot of traditions we hear about doing vipassana, vipassana, vipassana. But then the shamatha sort of gets forgotten about. And in Tibetan Buddhism we always a lot talk about, you know, emptiness practice or deity yoga or, you know, bodhicitta practice. But then where's the shamatha practice? It sort of gets left out. So I think, unfortunately, across the board in nearly all Buddhist traditions, when it actually comes to practice, it seems to sort of get left out. So I think that's very unfortunate, particularly in terms of our modern society, how our concentration skills tend to be very underdeveloped. If we want any of these practices, our vipassana, bodhicitta, emptiness, compassion practice, if we want any of these practices to be effective, we need a relaxed, stable and clear mind. So that's why I'd like to spend a bit of time tomorrow morning looking at that. So any last question? Otherwise we will finish there for today. Okay, looks like everyone wants to... Oh, last question.
Is it the kind of practice I should engage in as a beginner because I'm kind of a distracted person or is driving around everything?
A very brief answer and then I'll more tomorrow morning is yes, I think as a beginner, particularly if we are heavily distracted or dull, then if we don't put some effort into this, then we can put a lot of effort into emptiness, bodhicitta, and you know, we know, and they won't really be effective. We know from our own experience in daily life, if we're not focused on something, we can't do it well. You know, in surfing, you know, if you're not focused, you just fall in the water, no, down. If you're not focused clearly on solving a problem at work, you'll never solve it. So same thing. Of course, I'm not suggesting we just do shamatha practice and forget about everything else. But it certainly needs to be an integral part of our practice as a beginner, and I'll talk more about that tomorrow morning. Okay? So let's break there. The next session is more wisdom-based, I think, meditation from Richard. So you're going to be, I think, looking at this dukkha in terms of trying to understand and experience what dukkha is. And then this evening, you'll be going in some detail for the first half of the session at least through these points here in the meditation prayers. And then I think the plan for the later part of the meditation this evening is precious human life, to reflect on precious human life. So let's have a break and then come back. Remember, you'll be meditating at 5:15. There's no gong, so you'll have to keep an eye on the time. And then I'll see you tomorrow morning. Oh, what to read tomorrow. That's right. If you want to prepare a little bit for tomorrow, then in your book, the two practices of conventional and ultimate bodhicitta have been reversed, so you'll have to go a bit later in the book. So it's going to be page 48 to 53. And in the commentary here, just page 91. So just page 91. So that's if you want to prepare a little bit for tomorrow. And of course, before we get into that, tomorrow morning we're going to be looking at this chart in the first session or two. So again, you may like to have a look at this chart and read a little bit of what's written on the back as well. That could be helpful preparation. Okay, so let's break there and then I'll see you tomorrow morning.